Support for this episode of the podcast comes from our patrons at Patreon. Go to patreon.com/chasingearhart to join the chase and become a patron today. On the morning of July 2nd, 1937, Amelia Earhart and her navigator Fred Noonan disappeared over the Pacific Ocean without a trace. 81 years later, all over the world lie scattered pieces of their puzzle, waiting to be put together. Welcome to Season 2 of the Chasing Earhart Podcast.
Amelia Earhart was the most famous career woman of her time.
She was a beacon of hope, not only to women, but to everyone because of the times.
Amelia Earhart was a comet that shot across the sky in the 1930s and then just disappeared. Sometimes in order to teach people, you have to inspire them first. And when Amelia Earhart would go in and talk to a class about flight, she'd done it. And she was successful in inspiring them.
She stood as an example of someone who believed in herself and who knew that one's abilities really mattered most. It didn't matter if you were a man or a woman.
I think Amelia's impact is still felt, but maybe we need to listen to it again. Some of the same verbiage that Amelia said back then, oh, women, you can be scientists and you can be engineers and you can be anything you want. I think the legacy is that we need to keep listening to what she said because we're not there yet.
May I hope this movement will spread throughout all branches of applied science and industry, and that women may come to share with men the joy of doing. Those can appreciate rewards most who have helped create.
Of all the aspects of her storied career, perhaps the one that Amelia Earhart coveted most was her relationship with Purdue University. Lasting only a precious short time, Amelia saw her role with Purdue as the second chapter in her already historic aviation career. Poised to make a monumental impact on women in the early days of what would become the STEM movement, Amelia built relationships and made an impact that still resonates through the halls of Purdue to this very day. Known as the largest Amelia Earhart archival collection on the planet, the Purdue Archives has been visited by everyone who is anyone in the Earhart community. The most cited resource in the over 400 Amelia Earhart books that currently sit on the market, authors, educators, researchers, and fans continue to visit the archive every day to get a sneak peek into the life of one of America's biggest icons. Tonight, on the 61st episode of the Chasing Earhart podcast, we are joined by project guest and Professor Sammy Morris of Purdue University via Zoom to break down and discuss the Amelia Earhart collection, Amelia's relationship with Purdue, and why Amelia's presence and influence can still be felt throughout the campus and all who attend there. Tonight is a banner night for the Chasing Earhart podcast because back in 2013, when we decided that we were going to launch a podcast, our team decided that my guest tonight was going to be our very first guest on the podcast. Well, it turns out that it takes a little while to track her down, but we finally got some time with her. And tonight is my pleasure to finally have Professor Sammy Morris on the show. Sammy, I've been waiting to say this for a while now, but welcome to Chasing Earhart.
Thanks so much, Chris. I didn't know that about being the selection for the first interview. I'm wowed and honored.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah, it was really one of those things where we have had many meetings about it and said, yeah, we're going to kick this off with Sammy. And then it's just, I know your schedule is insane. So it's just, you know, it's hard sometimes to track certain people down because they're so busy. But I'm so glad that you gave us the time tonight. It's really going to be exciting for us.
Well, thanks for having me.
Absolutely. Now, this, of course, isn't our first time working together. Sammy took part in Chasing Earhart, the discussion panel here in July in Atchison at the Amelia Earhart Festival. And we were so overjoyed that you were able to come out here and clear some time to be with us for that event. We had a blast that week, and it was so great. And we were just happy to have you then as well.
It's a great experience for me, too.
Yeah. Now, let's do this. Let's get some housekeeping out of the way before we begin here. Now, can you tell us a little bit about your education and your professional background?
Sure. So my master's degree is in library and information science, and that's from University of Texas at Austin. And I was able to specialize in working with archival materials. So they have a special concentration track within the library school there for archival enterprise. Prior to that, I have a bachelor's in English degree from Northwestern State University, Louisiana Scholars College. So my background is pretty much in the humanities and liberal arts, with mostly a focus on caring for historical materials like archives, manuscripts, and rare books.
And we're definitely going to get into that in just a little bit. Now, I'm very curious to know your answer to this question, because it's one that I ask of everyone that ever sits on the show with us. And it's a question I asked just to kind of get things started. But can you tell me, do you have any early recollections of Amelia Earhart? And when did she first come into your life in a professional sense?
You know, I remember always admiring her from the time I was a child. I can't pinpoint the exact moment that she was on my radar, but I'm pretty sure that it happened in just a history class probably in middle school or elementary school, where, you know, you always learn about the important figures in history, and it's like 99% white men. And I remember Earhart, you know, she stood out for me, Amelia Earhart, and also Eleanor Roosevelt, which coincidentally I found out many years later had a friendship. I guess I felt really close to both of them because there weren't a lot of women being taught in the history textbooks other than wives of presidents, which I didn't find as interesting.
Yeah, no, what we're going to do is I think is something a little bit different for this episode of the show. I want to give everyone a little exposition before we set up Amelia's connection to Purdue. And please correct me if I'm wrong on anything I get here. On September 26th and 27th of 1934, then Purdue president Edward C. Elliott had heard Amelia Earhart speak at a luncheon in New York on women's careers. And he was so impressed with her talk that he asked if she would visit Purdue and give a lecture for the women students there. And Amelia spoke at a banquet at Purdue on October 17th, I believe it was, in 1934, in a talk that she titled Activities for Women After College. And then after several talks with President Elliott, a contract was negotiated in 1935 stating that Earhart would be employed by Purdue as a visiting faculty member. And from autumn of 1935 until her disappearance, of course, in 1937, Amelia served as a consultant in the Department for the Study of Careers for Women and a technical advisor in the Department of Aeronautics for Purdue. And when I first learned about this, probably about 10 years ago, I had asked myself this question, and I'll ask you to give your thoughts on it now. Did Amelia Earhart pioneer sort of an early STEM revolution before STEM was even a thing at that time?
Oh, that's a really good question. I mean, I think back in the 30s, Purdue was definitely a major player with STEM, especially engineering. But in its earlier years, when it was founded in 1869, it was very agriculture focused. And so what a lot of people don't realize is Purdue is a land grant institution, kind of like a traditional A&M. So it really focused on agricultural and mechanical arts in the early years. In terms of the STEM revolution, I don't know. It's possible that that was already kind of happening, but I think what Amelia definitely did was get it on the radar of women that these could be potential career paths for them as well. And not only was that revolutionary then, I mean, it's still kind of revolutionary today, the fact that we're trying to constantly recruit women and diverse people into engineering programs. But I think the other thing that's really interesting about that is that, you know, Amelia really felt strongly that women should have careers, period. And in the 1930s, that was still unusual. The model was women, if they went to college, they did that to meet their husband, and then they got married and they started families. And so she really was, you know, rocking the worlds of the women students on campus by basically telling them something that they had perhaps not considered, which is you don't just have to get married and stay at home and take care of the house and the children after you graduate from Purdue. You can actually pursue your own career dreams. And I think it's really neat that she was thinking about, you know, pointing some of these women into STEM disciplines, and that was probably going to be quite shocking to the male students and the faculty as well. One of the things that's really cool in the collection that a lot of people don't know about is she started coming up with a design for like a handyman's course for women. And it would be a class where women could like tinker with engines and machinery without feeling like they were, you know, being pitted against the boys or in some way being looked down on by the male students. So she loved the idea of like giving women the freedom to explore kind of their tomboy sides or their interests in STEM or non-traditional, basically non-traditional roles for women.
two things there. So I didn't know that she was actually tinkering with an idea of that. That would be, that's remarkable. I had no idea that she was doing that. And secondly, you mentioned a little bit of sort of, you mentioned kind of to the amazement or to the kind of bewilderment, so to speak, of some of the staff and the male faculty. Do you think, well, I don't know if it's speculative or not, but did she have a lot of blowback and from like just a different side of her different point of view? Was there any negativity or any negative blowback to her early days in Purdue?
It's a really good question because, you know, if you look at just the official written documentation of Earhart's time at Purdue, you would never know that there was. But one of the amazing source materials we have in our collection is an interview with Dorothy Stratton, who lived to be over 100 years old. Dorothy Stratton was the dean of women students at Purdue when Amelia Earhart was there, and they shared an office. So some of the anecdotal things we know about Earhart's time on campus that wouldn't have made it into anything official, we know from this interview with Dorothy Stratton. And in that interview, she talked about how there were a couple of things that Earhart got pushed back on. The main one was that one of the male faculty members in engineering did not feel she was qualified to be on the faculty of Purdue because she didn't have a college degree. The other thing that was a major pushback, and this was from both genders, was that Amelia would walk around on campus in pants, and they did not allow the women faculty, staff, or students to wear anything but skirts and dresses. So she really pushed the boundaries, but at the same time, I think even the people who were critical of her were willing to see and acknowledge that she was an amazing influence on the women students, that she gave them hope, and that she encouraged them to, you know, do what they wanted to do instead of sort of settling for what society expected of them. And so I feel like from the little bit I know from that time period, the people who interacted with her did feel respect for her, even if they felt a little bit of consternation sometimes about how she wasn't the typical woman on campus.
How much time did she spend there? And I know she was, you know, the contract was negotiated for her to be a visiting faculty member, but did she spend a lot of time at Purdue?
No, she would come for several weeks at a time. And so I think the agreement, it's never been really spelled out in the hiring documentation that we have for her when she was expected to be on campus. But I know from correspondence with her and the president and the dean of students, Dorothy Stratton, that she would come a little bit of time each semester between the fall of 1935 and basically the end of 1936. So we know that there were about three semesters at Purdue where she would spend between 2 weeks and a month on campus, and she would stay in the women's dormitories, and she would share an office with the dean of women's students. And mostly what she was doing in that time was meeting with students, with faculty, staff, and members of the local community. But a lot of her time was just spent talking to students, trying to get a sense of, you know, what were their career interests and how could she help them. She did a survey that was basically asking women why they might want to consider having careers after graduation. And the survey is just absolutely hilarious because she basically, it's a multiple choice survey where she gives them all of the answers she wants them to give her. And so it says things like, why would I want to consider a career after college? And some of the choices are financial independence, having a feeling of satisfaction of doing a job well done, you know, not being bored. It's all of these things that you could tell she wanted to make the women students think about why they would actually want to have careers. So I think I've wandered off track. I've completely forgotten what your question was, Chris. I'm sorry.
No, that's okay. No, yeah, you didn't actually wander off track. I think it's just, you know, I want to give people like sort of an understanding of kind of how heavily she was involved with Purdue. It seemed like, and we'll get into this in a little bit, but she really truly cared about that role. I think it was a role that she really kind of held in very high regard in her career.
I do believe that. And I think that she was very grateful to Purdue because one of the things she wanted the most whenever she joined Purdue in 1935, she started talking immediately about how, you know, what she really wanted was a plane that she could do on longer flights. And she was already beginning to think about her longest flight yet, which was what ultimately became Plans for the World flight at the equator. So she's talking about these things that are like her big grand dreams, and basically Purdue stepped forward and raised the funds to enable her to purchase her Lockheed Electra, which is, you know, as most people know, the plane that she disappeared in. And so I think she felt extremely grateful to Purdue because she had two primary interests that were sort of like her passions in her life. One was helping other women and encouraging them, and one was aviation. And at Purdue, she could do the two things she loved the most. She could be a technical advisor in aeronautics. She could, you know, fly her plane in and out of the airport there and tinker with it. She could also interact directly with young women and the women faculty and staff, all of whom found it really valuable to hear her very unusual opinions, basically, about what women were capable of and what they should be allowed to do. So I feel like one reason we have such a strong connection between Purdue and Amelia Earhart is that, you know, these were the last 2 years of her life. She already was famous. She knew where she wanted to go from there, which was really one more grand flight. And to be honest, as much as Amelia Earhart loved flying, I do not think that she necessarily loved the, I guess I would say, the sensational side of doing these big flights. I think, and this is just an inference on my part, but from some of the things she wrote around that time, she wanted to do one more grand flight and then kind of retire her career. Not to stop flying, but to stop maybe always being in the spotlight and feeling like she had to do something better and sort of top her previous records, and maybe just relax a little and not constantly doing speeches and talks all over to try to raise funds for all of these grand flights. She said some interesting things in some letters and things that we have in the collection where it makes it sound to me like she's saying to family and close friends, you know, I love flying, but I'm kind of ready to just relax and be a normal person. So I feel like what happened is Purdue gave her the chance to finance, you know, her grandest flight yet, and then she was going to kind of slow down a little. And so I think that she felt grateful to Purdue for giving her that opportunity, which basically, if the world flight had been completed, you know, it would have instantly meant that she was even more famous than she had been, because she would have made the longest flight across the world by herself. And I think that people would have seen that, you know, she didn't have anything else to prove, which honestly, I don't think she did anyway. I think maybe there was a bit of, you know, pressure she placed on herself to keep doing more and to stay in the limelight so that she could continue to be basically heard about her opinions on women in aviation. I think she did these grand flights for the publicity because it was a way to make sure that she could get her voice across about, you know, basically giving women equal opportunities to men, valuing women. And she wanted people to see that flying was safe. She wrote a lot of articles when she was aviation editor for Cosmopolitan magazine, where basically she was just trying to encourage people that flying was a safe method of travel. And this was unusual at that time in the late 20s, early 30s, because most people did not fly. They took other modes of transportation, and flying was mostly like for mail delivery or, you know, transport of other things. So she was ahead of her time in a lot of ways, but I think the two things she cared about the most on a personal level were helping other women and helping the aviation industry. And so since she was able to kind of do both at Purdue, I think we kind of had a special place in her heart. And that's why I really think that, you know, her husband, George Putnam, knew that. And after Amelia disappeared, for a short period of time, all of her collection actually that we received ultimately at Purdue went to a women's archives in New York. And it only was there for a very short period of time because the women's archives closed. It was dissolved, and they contacted all the donors and said, you know, we want to return the collections to you. So what happened is Amelia disappeared in 37. She was declared dead in 39 in court. Her estate was settled. Her papers and collection and so forth went to the women's archives in New York. Then they closed, and by 1940, George Putnam, her husband, got the collection back from that archives and gave it to Purdue. So we've had it since 1940, although George Putnam's granddaughter, Sally Putnam Chapman, made some really important additional donations to that collection as recently as 2002. So that's kind of my long-winded answer, I guess, about Earhart's relationship with Purdue and why I think it was special to her, because I think that the university, particularly Edward Elliott, did everything they could to sort of make sure that Earhart was getting what she needed out of the relationship, that it wasn't just about benefiting Purdue, that it was also about benefiting her, which in her case was really about helping make her last grand flight happen.
Yeah, there's so much great information that you gave out there. And one of the things that really stood out to me, I think, was just kind of how you outlined sort of Amelia's maybe personal thoughts on how she felt. And I tend to agree with you that I think that she was really done after this with long distance stunt flying, at least. I think that she would have been, you know, once you've reached the top of the mountain, there's nowhere left for you to go. I mean, that's once you've done everything there is, that's it. And I think you had eloquently put that she was already very famous and already very well known. But I think maybe she might have seen Purdue as an outlet to really kind of kick off sort of the second phase of what would become her career at that point. I mean, it was kind of teased for the last couple of years because she really got a chance to get into it and kind of start doing things. But I think that she would have, you know, continued her career just from a teaching standpoint or just an advisory standpoint after the stunt flying and after the world flight was completed. I think that you're probably right. She probably would have flown, but not maybe just more for an intimate reason, for her personal reasoning, but not for, you know, worldwide fame. I think she was probably maybe done with the fame at that point, maybe just kind of like, okay, I want to get into something else. I want to now influence, sort of like what people do that, you know, once they're at the end of their careers, they want to kind of influence the next generation. Maybe that's what she was thinking.
Yeah. I mean, it's totally opinion on my part, but it's based on, you know, reading the things that she wrote, where I just get the sense that, you know, she had a lot of important work she wanted to do. And I think that she wasn't necessarily someone who really like thrived in the spotlight. She could do it and she could do it very well, but you could kind of tell that, you know, from some of the videos of her, she was a little bit shy on camera. And so I don't think it was something that she ever felt like she was 100% in her element being in the spotlight. But I think that because advocacy for women and for flight were so important to her, that she made herself go through the interviews and the lectures and the films and, you know, all of the media exposure. I don't think she resented it. I think she knew it was an important outlet for her to use to get her point across. But at the same time, I suspect she was starting to feel kind of tired of it. And at this point in her life, maybe looking at, like you said, you know, maybe just doing lecturing or teaching, or maybe just, you know, pursuing other interests that she probably had to put on hold because of her constant flying and media interviews and lecturing. You know, what a lot of people don't know is she and her husband, George Putnam, were not well off at all. I mean, they were comfortable, but all of their money was going into financing these grand flights. And so this is one reason she had to do so many lectures just to try to make ends meet so that they would have money for the flights. It's also why she did, you know, some advertisement type things, promoting products and so forth, because they weren't well off at all, even though people kind of assumed they were. So I feel like maybe she was kind of at a point where she wanted to do other things that interested her. She'd always had a lifelong interest in writing, and particularly she loved poetry, and she had written some poems when she was younger and even submitted some for publication. And so I think there were these other things that she perhaps had on her mind as wanting to pursue, but had been putting aside for the limelight. And maybe she was starting to feel like, you know, it was a good time to step out of the limelight and do some other things.
I don't know. It's a speculation, or if you know, is there any information out there on how it came to be exactly that it was negotiated with Purdue to supply the Lockheed Electra for the world flight? Do we know like any details about that? Is there anything in the archives that talk about that?
There's not very much in writing. What we know is basically from, I guess, Edward C. Elliott, our president. There's a collection of his papers in the archives, and there's some correspondence early on between him and Amelia and George Putnam about setting up, you know, how they would hire her and what her role would be. It's very vague. It's not detailed at all. It's clear that Elliot's main goal was to get her on campus, and he was going to make it as easy for Earhart as possible to kind of fit that into other things she wanted to do. But regarding the Lockheed Electra, a lot of it is speculation. And I there's just not as much in writing about that, I think, as any of us would hope. We do have the contract that when Earhart purchased the Lockheed Electra, we have that in the collection. We have some information from Paul Mance, because he was also involved in getting the plane and getting it equipped the way she wanted it to be. I'm sorry, I meant Fred Noonan. So I think that regarding what Purdue's role was, the only documentation we really have is, I think it's in the Purdue Board of Trustees minutes. It talks about how Purdue was establishing an Earhart Fund for aeronautical research, and that fund is basically where the members of the Purdue Research Foundation and other major donors like Lilly and David Ross and, you know, people in industry. There were people from Bendix Corporation and Goodyear and Goodrich. All of these corporate sponsors and members of the Purdue Research Foundation donated money to go into this new fund that was set up called the Earhart Fund for Aeronautical Research. And then that fund was what was used to basically give money to Earhart so that she could outright buy the plane in her own name. So the plane, even though it was financed by Purdue, was never in Purdue's ownership, technically speaking. It was all under Amelia's ownership. But there are media interviews and newspaper clippings from around this time where Earhart's talking about how the plan was, after this world flight, the plane would come back to Purdue and it would be used for teaching and research. So even though it doesn't appear that Purdue had a contract with her directly about what to do with the plane, there seemed to at least be some sort of verbal understanding between Earhart and the university that the plane was really meant to continue to be used by the university.
You know, and I've often wondered about this, just in private thoughts. She always referred to the plane as the flying laboratory, and I refer to the plane as that typically when I do media and stuff. But I wonder where that came from, like the idea of calling it a flying laboratory. I wonder if that was influenced by her work at Purdue and kind of what she was getting into, and getting into more of the scientific aspects of things, and just really trying to kind of become an explorer, so to speak, and become of kind of a, you know, the scientific approach. I wonder if the flying laboratory term came from that.
Oh, it absolutely did. There's no doubt. I've seen newspaper clippings from the year that she got the plane where she was calling it the flying laboratory. And I believe that the reason for that, I think there are two reasons. The first is, you know, Earhart genuinely was interested in research that affected pilots. In particular, she was interested in how does long distance flying affect the pilot in terms of fatigue, diet, stress, physical health. She was interested in those things. So for Purdue to be able to justify giving her all of this money for the plane, remember, the funds are coming from the Purdue Research Foundation. And so for them to justify it, it needed to have some sort of research focus to this plane purchase. And so I think that what happened was that they negotiated with her on, you know, what can you use this plane for that will relate to research? And she already had an interest in, you know, things like, because she had written articles and given speeches in the past, even before she was affiliated with Purdue, about, you know, what a pilot eats when a pilot is doing like a 36-hour nonstop flight. What do they eat while they're flying the plane? Or, you know, how does it affect the pilot to go that long without sleep? How do they stay awake? So she had these research interests already, and then Purdue Research Foundation is coming in and saying, you know, we'll give you the money for the plane if you'll use it for research. So she basically started calling it, I think, the flying laboratory, because it was reflective of that role that the plane would be used not just for this long-distance flight, but to gather some information, some data that could be used for further research studies. And one of the things that I think is really fascinating that I don't think ever happened, but it could have, is I've seen in writing in some of these media interviews with her during her time at Purdue where she talked about how she was going to take some sort of net with her on this plane and I guess stick it out of a hatch or something and collect particles from the air, because her idea was she was going to kind of look at what was being collected in this net for some sort of research. I'm not exactly sure what. I don't know if that ever happened, because I think once they got the plane and it was specially equipped for her specifically to fly really long distance, carry as much gasoline as it could. I think once they got into all of the plans for the world flight and getting the plane ready, that it's perhaps that was put aside. But I really don't have any evidence either way. They might have, you know, on that first flight attempt actually gathered some data like that. But if they did, I haven't seen any evidence of it.
I hadn't heard of that either. That's pretty remarkable. When I hear things like that, I keep thinking about her status as really a visionary, because I really feel like, and I know you mentioned this earlier in our conversation, that, you know, whether it was kind of already in the early stages of, I mean, obviously it wasn't STEM at the time, but I mean, I feel like this is a woman that just had a vision that was just like 100 years ahead of anybody else's idea of what we could, you know, what we could accomplish and what women specifically could accomplish, and just equality. And when I hear you talk about things like that, it kind of affirms those thoughts that I have in my head.
Yeah, I completely agree with you. And I think this is one reason she captured my interest really early on too, is, I mean, the thing that's so remarkable is not only was she ahead of her time, but in some ways she's ahead of ours. I mean, if you look at the premarital letter that she gave her husband the morning they were going to get married, she said some things in there about monogamy and marriage that are still revolutionary to this day. And so I do think she was a visionary, and I think that's how she's able to continue to capture the interest of people, especially young women today are still fascinated with her. And so there's something about her that is just completely timeless. It's not just that she disappeared before she was 40. It's also that she had ideas that were so far ahead that, you know, we're still catching up with some of them. And she strongly believed, for example, that military service, if it was mandated for men, it should be mandated for women too. And furthermore, she believed we shouldn't have wars and shouldn't, you know, be involved in armed conflict. But if we were, if we needed to be, then she thought women should also be drafted. And that's something, you know, we still haven't gotten to that point. So I'm astounded with her.
Yeah, gosh, you know, that's, you know, and as you're talking about that, I'm thinking about the Wasp, you know, and I'm thinking about that. And I'm thinking about that obviously wasn't established after she disappeared, but I wonder, I know this is just speculation if between you and I, but I wonder how she would have felt about, I mean, you know, 1941, Pearl Harbor happens, and then, you know, the draft happens, the men, you know, have to go to war, and who steps up to run the country but women? And then you have the Wasp that's established at that point, and they're fighting for, you know, their rights to be able to fly and to do things on the military side. I wonder how Amelia would have felt about that, and I wonder what role she would have played. I wonder how fired up that would have made her.
Yeah, I'm kind of curious about that too. On the one hand, I know she was really opposed to war, because the reason that she dropped out of college was that her sister Muriel was living in Canada, and Amelia had gone there to visit her. And of course, Canada was involved in the war at this time, even though the U.S. wasn't. And she had this amazing experience that had a profound influence on her life. She was helping out at a hospital there with her sister, and they would spend a lot of time out at the landing field nearby, because a lot of the people who were coming into the hospital to get treated were pilots. So they started hanging out, Amelia and her sister Muriel, at the landing field. One day she saw several people, I think it was four men, all walking across the landing field on crutches. And she just felt immediately like she needed to drop out of college and go help somehow with the war and the wounded. So she became a voluntary nurse, and basically that was why she left college, was because she wanted to help. But it wasn't just a patriotism thing. She felt a strong sense of empathy about the people being hurt, and I think kind of felt like it was needless, you know, that the war didn't need to involve this level of devastation and casualties and you know, pain and destruction to people's lives and their bodies. And so this is one reason I've always felt, even though I do make a strong effort, because I don't want to misrepresent Purdue's views on what happened to Earhart in her disappearance, I want to make it clear that what I say is my own opinion.
Right.
I feel very strongly that she was not captured by the Japanese or in some way a spy, because she was so opposed to war personally that I don't think she ever would have done anything like that that would have promoted our war efforts or our strategic, you know, advancement into a war. I think some of the other theories have possibility, but that is one that I feel like just never would have happened, because I do not think she would have ever supported any endeavor that would have led to the harm of other people.
Yeah, you know, that's, you make an excellent point. That's an excellent argument, I think. And I there's one question regarding the disappearance that I want to ask you, but it's Purdue related. And the question I want to ask, and I've always really wondered about, is we've always talked about, you know, on this show, how her disappearance sort of affected different areas of you know, people, like, you know, whether it was disaffected people that were fans of hers, the aviation community in general, just, you know, women that looked up to her. But I wonder if, do we know, and it, again, it might be speculation, but do we know how her disappearance kind of affected Purdue and just the environment at Purdue? And, you know, she was obviously working there, as we've been talking about in this conversation tonight, but how did that affect Purdue just as a whole at the time?
I think it was really difficult, especially for the people who had worked there with Amelia for, you know, the 2 years that she'd been interacting with Purdue. Although, you know, in some ways, for the year of 1937, she wasn't really around much. She did come to the university, we know, in March, because she left from the Purdue airport when she started the first leg of her world flight, the one that ultimately, you know, ended at Luke Field. She left purposely from the Purdue airport, I think, as part of, like, promoting her connection to Purdue. But setting that aside, looking at, like, how her disappearance affected the university, there were people who were very close with her, like Edward Elliott and Dean of Women Dorothy Stratton, who I mentioned earlier, who, you know, basically shared an office with her and became close friends. There were also the students that she interacted with, and we have a lot of wonderful photos in our collection showing the time she spent on campus hanging out with students and getting to know them. And we know from anecdotal evidence and interviews with Dorothy Stratton that Amelia would come to the residence halls, not just for sleeping, but she would stay in the dining area for her meals often, and she would sit down and eat with the women students. So, you know, she made an impact on campus. And after she disappeared, President Elliott was interacting quite a bit with George Putnam, letting him know, you know, how worried everyone was and offering anything that they could do to help. Putnam continued to hold out hope for several months after the Coast Guard ended their search that, you know, maybe she could be found, and he continued to use whatever funds he had left, which weren't a lot, to try to sponsor his own search after the official Coast Guard one ended. So there were these things happening, and then there was the sort of the impact on the students. And even though we've never seen any writings or interviews with students from the time, one piece of evidence we have about how it impacted students is there's a yearbook for Purdue University students. And the year after Earhart disappeared, they had a whole sort of memorial tribute in the student yearbook to her. And there's mention in the Board of Trustees minutes of the university about how the university set up a memorial scholarship in Earhart's name. And of course, we have a residence hall that's part of part of the original women's residence halls that's named for Earhart today. It's called Earhart Hall, and there's a large sculpture, lifelike or bigger size sculpture of Earhart right in front of it. You can go to the airport today, and you can see photos of her and be reminded that this is the hangar where she kept her plane. So, you know, there were the people who knew her who were clearly devastated. And then there's those of us today who still kind of feel a connection to her because of her presence all around campus. And I think even though we didn't get the opportunity to meet her, it's clear that she is wrapped up in Purdue's history and Purdue's wrapped up in her history in a way that, you know, continues to have meaning. We actually have two students right now, two undergraduate students at Purdue, who are doing independent studies on Amelia Earhart using our Earhart collection. And one of them, her specific research question is about Amelia's relationship to Purdue. And so she's going to be spending this entire semester diving into the archives and answering that question. So I think that, you know, it's clear that she had an impact on our university that continues, which is pretty incredible considering we really only had her for maybe a year and a half.
Yeah, that's, wow. Yeah, I can imagine. And we've been talking this whole conversation about the archives and about Purdue. And so now I want to shift gears a little bit and get into that. Can you tell us as an archivist and as a professor, can you speak to your role sort of as the head of the Amelia Earhart collection at Purdue, and what's that been like for you personally, and what's the greatest reward of that position?
Yeah, I'd be happy to. So my role with the collection is I guess I would say when I first started at Purdue, my role was to put the collection in order. There was no guide or inventory to the collection. It needed a lot of preservation work. Someone needed to go through it and put it in some sort of arrangement so that it'd be easier for researchers to use and create a guide to the collection and take some preservation measures. So I did all of that in my first year at Purdue, and it was a joy to be able to dive into these amazing letters and items of clothing and photographs and maps that belong to Amelia Earhart. I mean, there's no way to describe what that feels like to see and touch things that you know she saw and touched that belonged to her. So I went through and got the collection ready for researchers, created an inventory, put that online. We digitized the entire collection and made it available online. So all of those things are really to encourage research use of the collection. And we always try to keep in mind that not everyone can make a trip to Purdue to use this collection. So we need to make it as available as we can to people who are out of state, out of country, you know, people, young women in middle school who are maybe writing, papers for class about her and need to know what we have in the collection. So a big part of my role has been just to try to make the collection more available and to preserve it. We do a lot of promotion of the collection, like going around and giving talks to community groups or on campus or doing exhibits, working with classes to integrate learning about Amelia Earhart and the collection into the way that they learn about how to do research in their courses. So those are kind of my role right now. Whenever there's something major in the media about Earhart, which tends to happen on a regular basis because of the ongoing searches for the plane, I'm often contacted to give interviews or to share information about the collection. But mostly what I do is just try to sort of, I guess, advocate for the collection, not only for people to use it, but also for people to know about Earhart's connection to Purdue. And I feel like it's sort of a very small part of her life that people who are experts on Amelia don't even always know about. And so I feel like it's part of my job to make people aware that the connection to her with Purdue was so important because of the way it was tied in with her flight, which is ultimately tied in with her disappearance. I think in some ways my role over time has been a little bit more distant than I might have liked, because as I've grown in my career, I've worked at Purdue since 2003 now, so I've been there quite a while, and I had such a great time in those first few years putting the collection in order and just experiencing it, knowing what was in it and getting to know her through that experience. But unfortunately, you know, as things happen over time, you kind of move up in your career. And as I've become more and more in administrative roles as a unit head and as a director of the archives, I've had to kind of step aside with working so much directly with the collection. So a lot of times if a researcher comes in to use it, or we're doing an exhibit or something like that, there are other archivists who often will have that more hands-on role. I tend to continue to give a lot of talks about her because according to the people I work with that I supervise, I'm the one who knows the most about her. So that kind of becomes my role. But I think we all are really honored to have this collection here. We know what a privilege it is to have this close connection to Earhart and to be, you know, every day able to see these things that were part of her life. I guess I say all that to say, you know, if I had my way, I would just every day just sit down and look at the Earhart collection. But in reality, I don't get as much exposure to it as that. But I do get to talk about it a lot, I guess.
You know, it's you know, and hence one of the reasons why you're on the show tonight, but and hence what I want to really express to everybody is the Purdue collection is, and we've put in the research for this to sort of confirm this, but it's the most cited source of any source really when it comes to Earhart books. Like when you look at the actual Earhart books and everything, I mean, everybody cites the Purdue collection. It's a really important source of information, you know, when it comes to Amelia Earhart. And what I wanted to sort of ask you to kind of convey to everybody that's listening out there, because we have a lot of young folks that listen to the project, the fall that are in, you know, high school and early years in college and things. Can you just tell us just convey to them how important archiving is and how important collections like the one you have there at Purdue and like others, of course, around the world, how important are those to preserving history?
Well, I think that's a great question, first of all. And I am biased as an archivist. This is my field. But I feel like archives are absolutely critical to everything, because when we talk about archives with someone who is just a member of the public, they automatically think of old stuff or things that are valuable. And that is all true. But archives are also any original document that has long-term value, which means every person has their own personal archives, whether they realize it or not. So the things that give you legal rights, like the deed to your home or your land or your driver's license or your social security card or your birth certificate or your marriage license, those are all archives because they're official documents that basically are capturing in time something about you and your life that doesn't exist anywhere else outside of that one item. And so I feel like archives are absolutely critical to society for securing and maintaining our rights as citizens. You know, you look at like the Declaration of Independence and the Constitution, those are archives and they are living documents that we refer to every day to secure our rights. And so I feel like, you know, archives are also important because when you look at research and scholarship, so much of what we learn, especially from history textbooks, it's over and over citing the same secondary sources. And the problem with that is twofold. The first problem is it's the same information over and over. When you look at archives, there's a ton of information in there that no one's cited yet, so you're missing the full picture. The other problem with it is if one secondary source has an error and that keeps being copied over and over, then you're going to have the whole historical record is skewed. And I can give you a specific example. Well, actually two. One is that if you look in a lot of biographies and even reputable sources like biographical databases and dictionaries, it will tell you a certain year that Amelia Earhart graduated from high school. We know for a fact that year is wrong because we have her high school diploma in our collection, but it persists as a false statement that continues to be published by reputable scholars. The other example is that there is so much in these archival collections that one scholar could never incorporate everything in an archival collection into their biography or their research project. So if all you're doing as a new scholar is working from what's already been published, you're missing out on a ton of information. And this is why I say I feel like a lot of people don't know about Earhart's connection to Purdue, because they're doing their research based on all of these previously published books and articles. And if there hasn't been a book about Earhart's time at Purdue, then you're obviously missing out on that. So I, you know, like I said, I'm totally biased. I'll admit that freely, but I think archives are absolutely critical, not just to scholarship and research and history, but just to securing our lives as U.S. citizens, our rights, our privileges, our freedoms, because all of those documents that, you know, since our founding, our founders of this country, that those are archives. They exist in the National Archives. They exist in the Library of Congress. They exist in museums, archives, and libraries all over the country. And those are the evidence you can point to whenever you need to say, you know, this is the right that I have. So I feel pretty strongly about it.
It's really important to convey that information, because I, you know, we had David Ferriero on the show a while back, and he was talking about the importance of something he calls citizen archiving too, which I think is really kind of a neat term. And it's really kind of, it really just kind of relates to, obviously, you know, people archive, you know, doing their own archiving and actually, you know, passing their own history down. And that's really how archives grow. And I know that Purdue is, you know, it's obviously a lot of stuff's been donated to the archives. You mentioned Sally Putnam Chapman, and you mentioned, of course, the initial donation of George Putnam. How important is citizen archiving just in general, like when it comes to just people archiving their own history and then donating that history to archives, large archives that can protect it and keep it safe, like Purdue and other archives?
Oh, I think it's absolutely essential, especially because, and this is a problem widely acknowledged in the archives and library fields, we have the collections in libraries and archives reflect very much what's happening in society at a given time. So if you look at the history of what we collect in archives and libraries, we collected the stories of famous people, well-known people, a lot of white men. look at what's happening today. I mean, this is not a country of rich white men exclusively. And so if we don't have people collecting their own histories, those histories might not ever make it into the libraries and archives. And the reason that's just absolutely detrimental is it skews our history going forward. People will look back and, you know, a young African-American woman might be trying to find an example of herself in a history textbook and she can't find one. And the reason for that is somebody didn't save those collections and donate them to a place that could care for them over time. So I feel like it's every person's responsibility to try to capture their own history or their family's history, and then to go that extra step and make sure that either someone in their family is continuing to preserve it or that it's going to a place that can preserve it. Because, I mean, we're all part of society. We all have a part to play. We all have, you know, something that's basically our reason for being here. And whether you're famous or just an ordinary person, so a scholar of the future can learn something about this moment in time from studying your letters or your emails or your blog or your digital photos. You know, so much of what we capture today is digital, and I feel like that puts our history at risk because a lot of people don't realize that it's much, much more difficult to save something digital over time than it is paper. The digital materials are so susceptible to changes in technology that, you know, if anybody who remembers like WordPerfect and other past software that we can't use today, you know, think about all the things we're creating now that are the records of our lives that we may not be able to access in 10, 20, 50 years. I hope that people take that to heart and they do things like back up their important baby photos, you know, and the videos of their families and things like that. But it's something that takes ongoing work and maintenance, because if you just leave something on a hard drive or on the web, there's definitely no guarantee it's going to continue to exist for future generations to access.
Yes, very wise words from someone who knows. Now, I wanted to ask you one final question before we wrap up tonight, and that is about impact and legacy. If Chasing Earhart's about anything, it's about those two words. And I want to know, you know, I know we've touched on a little bit here tonight, peppered throughout this conversation, but can you tell me your own personal thoughts on what you believe to be Amelia Earhart's impact and legacy in 2018, not only at Purdue, but just worldwide?
Sure. I think her main impact and legacy have been on women and on aviation. I think that, you know, there's no doubt in my mind that because of the status Earhart had during her lifetime, you know, she was the equivalent of today's rock star. They had huge citywide parades in her honor. You know, people wanted to meet her, to touch her. She drew enormous crowds wherever she went. She had a huge influence on the way people thought about women because she was so outspoken about every little thing. If there was anything she perceived as being unequal or, you know, if some sort of injustice was being done, she was always upfront about it. And, you know, just as one example, there was a lot of criticism of women pilots when Amelia was a pilot. And she was very outspoken, including in court testimony, about how ridiculous it was, some of the things some of these doctors and scientists were saying, that women shouldn't be able to fly because they get their periods. I mean, this was what women were living with back then, that basically in anything you wanted to do that wasn't a housewife, you were, you know, someone would say, well, you shouldn't do that because you get your period. It's absolutely ridiculous. So she changed the way I think both men and women thought about what women could do. And that's had a lasting impact that continues to speak to people today. I think she also made a lot more people trust flying as a safe way of transportation. You know, those articles she wrote regularly for Cosmopolitan saying, you should fly, you should take your wife to fly, wives, you should take your husband to fly, wives, you should learn to fly yourself, be a pilot. You know, she opened people's minds, people who probably had never had anyone encourage them to have a career outside of the home. She was able to do that for women, and I feel like people still pick up on that love she had for just empowering other women. And this is why, you know, we get two-year-olds in the archives, two-year-old little girls in pilots' outfits who already have Amelia Earhart as their hero.
Wow.
That's, you can't, you know, there's no bigger impact than that, to know that this is someone who lived in the 30s who is still impacting young women today. How often can you say that about anyone?
Yeah, that's very true. Very well said. I know we talked a little bit about this tonight, your role in making the archives digital and helping with that. Where can people find the archives online?
Okay, great question. So if you go to the Purdue University Library's website for the Archives and Special Collections, there's a place on there that says eArchives, and you can click on that and go to the Earhart Collection from there. Or you can go to our link from the homepage for the archives that says Exhibits, and there's one specifically on Amelia Earhart. You can click on that and get some nice highlights from the collection if seeing the whole collection online is a little overwhelming. Because it's a very large collection, and it's a lot to try to browse. But we encourage people to use it and also to reach out to us if they have any questions.
Yeah, and absolutely. When we'll have the links to those in the show notes for tonight's episode. Sammy, it was a genuine pleasure tonight. Our team's been excited for this episode of the show in particular for a long time, and you didn't disappoint. Thank you so much for sitting in on the podcast with me tonight. It's been a pleasure.
Thanks, Chris. I appreciate that you did this, and it was a pleasure.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Chasing Earhart podcast, part of our Legacy Retrospective series. We hope you've enjoyed the show. Come back to ChasingEarhart.com each week for another new podcast. While at ChasingEarhart.com, visit our archives and our blog to hear all of our past episodes and interviews with guests such as Brad Meltzer, Tom Vinson, Candace Fleming, Jessica Cox, Abigail Harrison, and Shasta Ways. You can also hear interviews with representatives of all of the relevant hypotheses regarding the disappearance of Amelia Earhart and Fred Noonan, such as Tom King, Dick Spink, Gary LaPook, Rick Gillespie, Andy Sherrill, and more. Also at our site, you can find hundreds more posts, project updates, and much more information regarding the life and disappearance of Amelia Earhart. The Chasing Earhart podcast is a show without any sponsors or ads. We rely on support from listeners like you to keep the Chasing Earhart project operating. You can donate to the show, and as our thank you, receive bonus podcasts, merchandise, and advanced opportunities for Chasing Earhart events. Find a full list of available shows and rewards at patreon.com/chasingearhart. You can also follow the project on social media, where our team posts all of our shows, news, and project information. And that hashtag is @ChasingEarhart. The Chasing Earhart podcast is produced by Vanessa Williamson and edited by Tom Myers. Podcast music is provided by Dane Jarris Schmidt, and narration is done by Forrest Burgess. The opinions on Chasing Earhart are those of the individual guests and may not reflect those of Chris Evan Films Incorporated. Chris Evan Films Incorporated is not affiliated with the films or clips referred to herein. All movie clips and audio used in this podcast are the intellectual property of their respective copyright holders. They are included here for the purpose of historical education, and no infringement is intended. The Chasing Earhart podcast is an exclusive trademark of Chris Evan Films Incorporated and may not be used without the express written consent of Chris Evan Films Incorporated. All rights reserved. The Chasing Earhart podcast is a Chris Evan Films production. Copyright 2018. All rights reserved.